With that, I'll call this meeting of State Government Finance and Election Committee to order for Friday, March 5th. Pursuant to rule, House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. Representative Carlson, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Looked at them this morning. Look good to me. I'd like to move the minutes.
Okay, we'll move the minutes and then we'll take the roll. All in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. And Representative, and Ms. Spreck, can you now take the roll?
Chair Nelson.
Aye. I'm here.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Representative Bonner.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Cleborne.
Present.
Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Representative Mason. Representative New Brindley.
Present.
Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski present.
Representative Quam.
Present.
A quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Spreck. Now our first bill on the agenda this morning is House File 648. And members, we have a busy schedule today, so hopefully we can get through this. I want to be able to vote on this by 8:45. Representative Cagle, welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 648 be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 648 is a bill that came out of the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. We've been hearing from providers that they would have limits on the number of urine analysis screens that they can do for patients in treatment and recovery. And so what this bill would do is simply make it so there's no annual cap on the number of screenings that somebody can do for when they're in treatment, opioid treatment. And we worked with the health plans and DHS, and so we were able to get it to a place where both the health plans and DHS are neutral in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. And members, you'll note in your packet that there's two fiscal notes for this one, just for MMB, which looks like there is no cost to MMB. And then there's the other fiscal note that's for the entire bill. Are there any questions on the bill, members? Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Cagle. I noticed that the fiscal note says that there is no cost to, well, there'd be no cost to CGIP. I'm wondering why that is. Is the assumption just that the cost is so negligible that there's no effective cost, or it just seems a little surprising that there'd be no cost?
Representative Cagle, and maybe Ms. Roberts can help explain that if you need help. Representative Cagle.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would defer to fiscal staff. Sorry,
Ms. Roberts.
Me here.
Mr. Chair, members, if you look at the MMB portion of the fiscal note under assumptions, it says CGIP does not expect the fiscal impact from this legislation. Under the Minnesota Advantage Plan, CGIP's health plan administrators do not limit screenings or testing for opioids when those procedures are performed at in-network laboratories. And so that's why they concluded no cost.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll read more thoroughly next time.
Thank you, Representative. I see now we have a testifier, Elise Bailey from DHS. Ms. Bailey, you want to identify yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, hi, I'm Elise Bailey from DHS. I'm just here to answer any questions. I'm not necessarily here to testify on related to this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have the fiscal note. I had it up once. I'm going to grab it again. But how much is this going to increase healthcare costs? How much does it cost the healthcare access fund? How much will it cost individuals who are going to get tested more because of this? Can someone answer that?
I would think Ms. Bailey, if you could answer that, DHS.
Hello, Chair, Representative. We don't anticipate a cost related to our Minnesota healthcare programs because this bill is consistent with what we already pay for.
Representative Duskowski.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So we are already, so this is going to legitimize or legalize for the government behavior the government's already doing, but may not have the authority to do. Is that what I heard?
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I think one of the problems that we were seeing was on the private plans. They were not being able, when somebody was in treatment, that they were having their number of tests limited.
Representative Duskowski.
Could the person from the government that we heard from comment?
Ms. Bailey.
Hi, Chair members. I am representing the Department of Human Services, and so I can only speak to, you know, our medical assistance and Minnesota care programs that the state covers, and related to the public programs, this bill is consistent with what we already pay for. As far as the private plans and the insurance covering state employees, I think MMB or another member could speak to.
So, Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to get at, does DHS have the authority to do this now as they are paying for it? How does this impact the ability for the government to do things tomorrow after the bill passes that they can't do today?
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So as far as the public plans, as according to DHS, it wouldn't change that. What we're doing is we're aligning that with the private plans too, so that the private plans now can, somebody who's in treatment with a private plan isn't gonna not get the services that they need. You know, when you're in treatment recovery, part of it is making sure that you're abstaining from opioids. And so they need those tests to make sure that they're following their program. And what we heard from providers was that they were being prohibited or that they weren't getting reimbursed for their tests. And so most of the time the providers were just eating the cost of that.
Representative Duskowski,
So Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle, does this, is it only the private side that this gives additional, cost or increase in opportunity for providers to do these tests, or does it also address the same in the public side?
Representative Cagle.
Mr. Chair, members, it makes it uniform for public and private.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you. I think I understand what the bill does now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Cagle, quickly wrap up and we'll get to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just wanted to thank all the members for letting us hear this or hearing this bill. You know, I've been working with the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council for the past year and a half. And so we're really just looking to make sure that people in treatment and recovery are able to get the services they need. So thank you very much.
With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 648 be referred to the Health Finance and Policy Committee. Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Dreskowski?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleburne?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
Aye.
Representative Pulaski?
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
With a vote of 12 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails.
Thank you. The motion prevails. The bill's on to health, finance, and policy. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1039, Representative Freiberg. And we're planning on laying this over for possible inclusion in our bill. I'll move House File 1039 so the bill's before us. And Representative Freiberg, you have an amendment that was submitted late. You want to explain what that amendment does, and then we'll just discuss the bill. Representative Freiberg.
Sure. The amendment was not submitted before the committee's amendment deadline, but it would be my intention to have it incorporated into the bill at a later time. It reflects a suggestion from the Department of Administration to change the grants administrator of the program I'll describe when I describe the bill from the Department of Administration to the Council on Disability.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. And you want to describe your bill then?
Sure. House File 139 would create a grant program to fund sensory accessibility improvements in public places. Minnesota has historically focused on physical accessibility, and physical accessibility is obviously critically important to many, many people, but it doesn't meet the needs of all people with disabilities. The autism community and others with sensory needs would benefit from having accessible spaces in public access spaces throughout our state. My testifiers will give you some examples of sensory accommodations, but they frequently do not need to be major changes to structures or anything along those lines. This grant is a small investment to set an example for our whole state of how sensory-friendly accessibility options can improve our communities and increase inclusion. So I think with that, I have a few testifiers. I think Jillian Nelson might be the first one to go.
I have the list of we can start with Jillian. I have Trevor Turner on my list, then Jillian, and then Jen Reeder. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Nelson, and identify yourself and start and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and committee members, and thank you so much for this early morning meeting to discuss a bill very close to my heart. I'm Jillian Nelson, and I'm the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I'm also an autistic adult that experiences many sensory challenges. The movement of accessibility has been a hot topic throughout the Capitol complex the last couple of years, but with far too much of that conversation focused on accessibility modifications to public spaces to assist individuals with physical needs, such as parking ramps, bathrooms, handrails. And while we celebrate this progress and rejoice in the reduction of barriers, these changes do not increase accessibility for a large portion of the disability community. If we are going to focus on building inclusion and creating one Minnesota, then we need to include individuals with sensory needs, which often come with invisible disabilities. Individuals with autism comprise one out of every 44 Minnesotans. And they are not the only group that has sensory challenges. This would impact people with PTSD, mental health issues, developmental disabilities, and more. House File 139 is a two-year grant appropriation of $500,000 to allow for increased accessibility to public spaces, including state, county, city, and other public access spaces. The bill outlines four options that can be funded through the grant, including a quiet, sensory-friendly space, a design modification to the actual building to meet sensory-friendly standards, mobile kits to be used in the space, or additional service times or spaces meant to provide a quieter experience. This bill also has an expectation that organizations utilizing the grant will have appropriate training on utilizing the modifications. Our community has built our own accommodations for years in this arena and has gratefully had an influx of community partnerships creating recreational accessibility, such as the Vikings, the Minnesota Wild, soon to be joined by the Timberwolves and the Twins. We have seen groups such as Children's Theater, the Walker Arts Center, Minnesota Orchestra, Como Zoo, Minnesota Zoo, Three Rivers Parks, Minneapolis Parks, the Bakken Museum, the Science Museum, the Children's Museum, the Bell Museum, and also the Guthrie Theater. And while arts and recreation are vital to a meaningful life, they're not the only realm that people with sensory challenges require accessibility. I personally find it reprehensible that our state is leading the way in community sensory inclusion while our public spaces that are vital to civic and community engagement are still inaccessible from a sensory standpoint. This bill will create opportunities to create accessible spaces in public arenas that are vital to so many areas of our life. We must appear in county buildings to access supports. We need to access government buildings to advocate for our rights. We need to be in places that allow us to navigate our services, communities, and protections in a dignified manner without causing harm and discomfort. This bill may not seem life-saving to you, but people with autism experience suicide rates 3 times higher, and all too often this is because of isolation and exclusion. When we normalize accessibility, we normalize disability and increase acceptance in society. This type of systemic change will not only change buildings, but it will change the health and life outcomes for an entire population. I thank you for your support of House File 139, and I yield my time.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. The next person I have is Trevor Turner. Mr. Turner, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Trevor Turner, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. We wanted to express our support for House File 139 and also the amendment that Representative Fife proposing to move the grant program to the Minnesota Council on Disability. We're actually working on a similar bill with Representative Elkins on a grant accessibility program for digital accessibility. So we are more than willing and able and have the technical expertise to, you know, be the administrator of this grant program. The Minnesota Council on Disability supports House File 139. It creates a sensory accessibility grant program that can be used toward renovating spaces to be more accessible to those with sensory disabilities. Minnesotans are often excluded, Minnesotans with disabilities are often excluded from public spaces because they are inaccessible. Much like stairs are barriers to wheelchair users, PA systems are barriers to the deaf and hard of hearing, visual signs are barriers to the blind, and for spaces that are overstimulating, crowded, or have too many distracting lights, are barriers to those with neurological and sensory disabilities. It is a human right to have access to public spaces, but when those spaces are designed without disabilities in mind, entire communities are excluded. The Minnesota Council on Disability supports any bill that aims to make public spaces accessible to everyone and allows Minnesotans with disabilities to be active participants in their communities. Often when public spaces are designed, whether intentionally or unintentionally, with people with disabilities are left out of the conversation and the design process. Sensory disabilities have also been misunderstood, ridiculed, or maligned for centuries in government and public institutions. This means that many public spaces have been designed to prioritize aesthetics rather than functionality or accessibility. This bill seeks to rectify that by providing state agencies, counties, and cities in Minnesota funding to redesign their public spaces with sensory disabilities in mind. We urge the members of this committee to support this bill and support the disability community. Thanks to you again, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for your support of House File 139. I'm happy to take any questions, and I yield my time.
And the next person I have on the list is Jen Reeder. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, I'm Jen Reeder, and I am a parent of a child with autism, and I have spent the majority of my career working in the arts and the last decade trying to make public spaces and the arts more accessible to people with disabilities. I'll specifically share challenges my daughter has. She's about to start driver's ed, and how DMV and other places are like that with the lighting and the busyness and the hours. She will never be able to navigate that without accommodations. And she has a host of friends, and we have community members that have the same challenges of accessing spaces that you and I take for granted every day. And I think this is a perfect moment in history for this bill to be coming forward, as we have all learned in the last year in an incredible way how adaptations and accommodations can make life more accessible, can make life move forward, and just remove barriers and raise possibilities for all. It may, like Julian said, seem like a very simple thing, but this bill and creating accommodations in public spaces means the difference between my daughter not only enjoying life in a meaningful way, but her sharing her gifts and talents with the world in a meaningful way. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative New, I see you have your hand up as a quick with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I looked through all of our documents, and I couldn't find that amendment. I know we didn't move the amendment, but I'm just wondering if with that A1 amendment, with that shifting this to the Council on Developmental Disabilities, does that also change that 10% for admin?
Representative Freiberg, I've got the amendment here. It was in the packet that was emailed out to everybody. It's the HO 139A1 amendment. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. The amendment is posted on the committee's website. I did pull it up before this started. If you look to lines 1.6 and 1.7 of the amendment, it changes the word commissioner to the word council. So those are the lines dealing with the 10% set aside for administration. It just changes that so that the administration is housed at the Council on Disabilities instead of with the Department of Administration.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would the would the Council on Disabilities get that up to 10% rather than the Department of Admin?
Representative Freiberg.
I believe that is correct. Maybe Mr. Gehring or Ms. Roberts could confirm that.
Mr. Gehring?
Chair, Representative New Brindley, the amendment doesn't change anything about the access to the administrative costs, so it'd be the same for the council.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I still don't feel like I've got clarity. So that means the council could access that 10% for administrative costs as opposed to the Department of Admin.
Or Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brindley, yes, that's correct.
Great, thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It might be helpful if one of the testifiers gives one or two specific examples of the changes that they're asking.
Ms. Nelson.
Thank you, Representative Mason. So a sensory-friendly accommodation could be a number of things, and we outlined four options in the bill. So like a quiet space would be something along the lines of a specific room that's set aside in a building that has been designed with sensory-friendly needs. So it might have lower lights. It might have things that we call them sensory tools or fidgets. I actually have my fidget spinner right here, and a wealth of other fidget items. There might be seating that meets different sensory needs that wouldn't be met in the other world, like proprioceptive or vestibular. It's a little known fact that people actually have 8 senses, not the 5 that were taught on Sesame Street. For things like sensory-friendly building modifications, it might be something like switching out fluorescent lights or changing the way a building's painted to create an easier visual structure. For mobile kits, the Minnesota Wild is a great example. They don't have a separate space at their venue. Instead, you go to customer service and say, I have some sensory needs. They give you a menu. You pick out what items would meet your needs. They put them in a bag and you go back to your seat and you get to enjoy the rest of your hockey game with the support you need. And then the quiet times are an option. Like the Guthrie Theater is a great example of that one. They actually have what they call relaxed performances for many of their shows that are a specific day where the expectations of the theater are different. You're allowed to come as you are. If you need to move during the show, move during the show. If noise needs to be made during the show, make noise. And they have the sensory friendly space. So we really want to design this grant to allow public access spaces to decide what sensory friendly accommodation is best for their culture and their space and their purpose so that it could be the most meaningful to both the businesses and the community.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. The next person on my list is Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Mr. Turner, if you're still on. I agree with you. I think we have a huge government here in Minnesota. We spend billions of dollars on it. We need to make it accessible to everyone. I'm going to support the bill. But I'm wondering, have you talked to the governor or urged him to take down the chain link fence around the Capitol so that that too can be accessible to everyone?
Representative Mr. Turner, I don't know if that's the purview of this committee or Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Jokowski. No, we had not talked to the governor about the chain link fence surrounding the Capitol. Because of the pandemic, most of the Capitol is, you know, off limits for almost everyone. And I would say that most people with disabilities are avoiding crowded spaces and things because of the pandemic. So I would say it's not a major concern for the Council on Disabilities simply because the Capitol grounds are primarily just for representatives and senators to conduct business and to avoid pandemic-related illnesses.
Representative Jaskowski, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Turner. Mr. Chair, I hope that we can remove that barrier around the Capitol to restore the public's access to our Capitol. And I just think of the $300 million renovation that we did to make that place so beautiful. And now it's apparently being mothballed and not allowing people with disabilities or non-disabilities or everybody in the state to access it. Thank you for the bill, Representative Freiberg. Thank you, Mr. Turner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jaskowski. I see it, don't see any other hands up. So we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion. And thank you, Representative Freiberg, for bringing the bill. Members, the next bill on our agenda is House File 1088, Representative Carlson. And again, the intent is to lay this one over for possible inclusion. Representative Carlson, I'll move House File 1088 so it's before us. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you for moving House File 1088. Chair Nelson and members, House File 1088 appropriates a little over $1 million in general funds to Minnesota Public Radio for equipment grants in the 2022-2023 biennium. These grants ensure Minnesota Public Radio can provide essential emergency alert system services. Minnesota Public Radio is a statewide network, and its services it serves as the backbone of Minnesota's Emergency Alert System, or EAS. When emergency alerts are issued, MPR provides the alerts not only to its listeners, but also to all media outlets throughout Greater Minnesota. In fact, in 2020, so just last year, Minnesota experienced 37 emergency alerts. In the past 3 months, three Amber alerts have been issued. House File 1088 provides a grant to NPR to ensure Minnesota's EAS continues to be efficient and responsive to all Minnesotans. So with that, I have Mr. John Kavanaugh from NPR with us today to provide some additional testimony and to answer any questions.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kavanaugh. If you want to identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, I am John Kavanaugh, senior counsel for NPR. And thank you, Representative Carlson, not only for your introduction, but also for bringing this bill forward. Out of respect for the committee's time and agenda, I'm going to attempt to keep my testimony brief. I have prepared two handouts that are included in the committee's materials. I've also requested meetings with most members, and I'm available at your convenience to discuss this grant in more detail as well. As Representative Carlson stated, NPR serves as the backbone for Minnesota's EAS system. It's uniquely situated to do so as we reach 95% of all Minnesotans and 1 million listeners each week. No other state has such a resource. Most states rely upon daisy chains among media outlets to deliver their EAS alerts. This method is slower and less reliable. NPR does not simply deliver the EAS signal. Our staff also works with media partners throughout Minnesota to ensure the system is operating correctly, and we troubleshoot problems which may arise during tests of the system. NPR staff also serves on IPAWS board with state and local public officials to develop policies and procedures to improve the emergency alert system. File 1088 is flat funding in the form of a grant to NPR to offset some of our costs to maintain and replace equipment vital to Minnesota's EAS. For each grant dollar, NPR invests over $5 in equipment and repairs in the system. The grant is solely used for needed equipment repairs and replacements throughout Greater Minnesota. No general fund money is spent on NPR's metro stations, employee salaries, or programming. The handouts in your materials provide you with more details on the equipment purchased and repairs made within the MPR's 2021 grant. They also note the location of those investments. MPR is proud to be a partner with Minnesota to ensure the safety of its residents and appreciates the grants the legislature has provided us to maintain that partnership. Thank you. I will stand for questions.
Member questions. I see Representative Nash has his hand up. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And probably to the author or, yeah, to the author. So, Representative Carlson, this is not over and above base budget, is it, or is this an additional $1 million in appropriations?
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Chair Nelson, Representative Nash, my understanding from the materials I have is that this is a status quo grant request from NPR. That's the same request they've made for the past two biennium. In terms of beyond additional funding beyond current budget requests, perhaps House Research may have an answer while I look through my notes here.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members, this is base funding. That's the way that I would read this bill. So the same funding as NPR received in the previous biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If this then is base budgeting, why the bill and why are we calling it a grant? Because if I'm not incorrect, if it's deemed a grant, isn't there going to be a peel off to administer the grant?
Mr. Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, actually, the Department of Administration and the Office of Grants Management actually oversees this. So it is a grant, but you are correct that it is a base funding that has been carried over into other biennia.
Representative Nash.
I'm fine.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, members, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Carlson. And the next bill on their agenda, members, is House File 1693. And I'll move it to have it before us. And again, the intention here is to lay this over for possible inclusion. And Vice Chair Carlson, you want to describe your bill?
Thank you, Chair Nelson. So, House File 1693, this bill provides a number of miscellaneous updates to the laws governing the work of the Department of Administration. So this is their cleanup bill. A couple highlights. The bill changes the term Central Motor Pool to Enterprise Fleet, adds Department of Corrections Inmate Community Work Crew Program to the list of entities that can be exempt from state markings on their vehicles. Here's my favorite one, clarifies that retired state canine can be turned over to their handlers upon end of service. I'd also like to direct members to the House Research Overview, does a nice job of kind of breaking things down section by section to refer to all the changes. Mr. Chair, there also is an amendment to House File 1693, an author's amendment to the bill.
So I'll move the author's amendment, the A1 amendment. Representative Carlson, explain the amendment.
Sure. So the A1, this amendment aligns the date for the Minnesota State Demographer to notify local governments of census data with anticipated release of U.S. From the U.S. Census Bureau, given later than expected data. So things have been slowed down. So this helps align for those dates for the Minnesota State Demographer.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions on the amendment, members? If not, all in favor of the author's A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment's on. Representative Carlson, do you want to go to your testifiers now?
Yeah, so sorry, I did that a little backwards. The summary, I think, is pretty brief. With me today, I do have Julie Beiler from Department of Admin to provide some additional testimony.
Ms. Beiler, please identify yourself for the tape, and then you proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to pull up my presentation here. Go back one here. Thank you. My name, for the record, is Julie Beiler. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Administration. I want to thank Representative Carlson for carrying our bill today. You'll see that from the various provisions in the bill, the breadth of services that admin provides to state agencies and Minnesotans. And I will know that almost all of these provisions have been seen by this committee in past sessions. So the first items I want to highlight are the fleet and surplus services changes. As Representative Carlson mentioned, we want to change the references to Central Motor Pool to Enterprise Fleet. This is the name that admin currently uses and better reflects the work of our division. We also want to clarify the definition of a passenger motor vehicle for the purposes of state fleet, and then add the Department of Corrections Inmate Community Work Crew Program to the list of entities that can be exempt from state markings on their vehicles. This group has requested the ability to operate without the state of Minnesota identifier on their vehicles. And as Representative Carlson mentioned, we want to allow a retired state canine to be turned over to their handler. Currently, when a state canine retires, admin does not have the authority to turn the canine over to their handlers. And this puts admin in a difficult position, as trained canines typically require special handling and would not generally be released to the public. The handlers and their canines also share a special bond as partners focused on a common goal. And admin is requesting this authority to give retired state canines a good life after their state service. I think everyone can agree that this is the most important provision in our bill. Some changes to division offices. We want to, first, the State Historic Preservation Office. We need to do some statutory cleanups from the 2017 legislatively mandated transfer of SHPO to admin from the Minnesota Historical Society. We worked with MNHS on these changes, and they support these provisions. Also, we want to codify the Office of Enterprise Sustainability, which was created by executive order to assist agencies in meeting their sustainability goals and avoid energy costs. Also, we would like to update statutes related to the move of the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution. They moved from the Bureau of Mediation Services to admin in 2019. And I think many of the community members are familiar with the good work that OCDR does through the Civility Caucus. Next, some changes for the State Demographic Center. So we would like to repeal the obsolete Minnesota Milestones Report. MNB no longer uses this. They now have a Results First division that does this work. Results First includes an inventory of indicators to guide the budgeting process. And the state demographer publishes an annual report that is more flexible in response to current trends or interest areas. Also, we want to guarantee access to apartment buildings for U.S. Census workers. This would be the same access that candidates have. And apartment access turned out to be a problem during the census count last year, and we heard from cities that they wanted something they could point to in state statute. And then, as Representative Carlson mentioned in the amendment, we are going to modify the date of reporting population counts to local governments. So population estimates are currently due to local governments by June 1st of each year. And this change is needed this year because the 2020 census counts will not be published by the U.S. Census Bureau until at least September 30th. So this change would change the date to be delivered to 6 weeks after the census results are released instead of a date certain. So just after in years when it's a decennial census. We also worked with the Met Council on this change, and they are supportive. And then some changes to our facilities management division. We want to update the list that of buildings that are controlled by admin in statute. And finally, we want to remove an obsolete reference to the recycling center and materials handling services. The state's recycling center was closed in 2010, and we now contract for that work through a competitive bidding process. Thank you, and I will stand for any questions.
And members, I have David Kelleher as the next testifier, and then we'll get to questions. Mr. Kelleher, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. I'm simply here to answer any questions that might come up related to sections 9 through 18 of the bill, and we are supportive of those changes, which are technical in nature and finish off the transfer of the State Historic Preservation Office from Minnesota Historical Society to the Department of Administration. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kelleher. First person on my list is Representative Nash. Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Mr. Kelleher, as you know, I got to have a hand in the SHPO transfer several years ago, and along with Chair Anderson. So if you could let me know, or you could tell the committee, what are the technical changes, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, there are about nine sections that in various ways in Chapter 138 either delete Minnesota Historical Society and insert Department of Administration, or in one case, when the language that passed in 2017 made that change from MNHS to admin erroneously, we're changing it back to Minnesota Historical Society because that's an activity that we still do. And a couple of additional updates to the language that's now used in the federal laws related to historic preservation and clarifying what we do versus what admin does.
Representative Nash, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nothing at this time.
Thank you. Next person on my list is Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I guess now I have two questions, but the first one has to do with the Minnesota milestones. And I believe that was a bill that Senator Terrell Clark and I passed in 2010. And originally the admin wanted an exemption at that point because the person in charge of that was in charge of the census that year. And the reason for that is because, as far as I know, we have no state guidelines. And that was the intent of that. And then afterwards, I know we have a new demographer, and it was said that demographer is bringing in guidelines. But as far as I know, when we are making our bills and passing bills, we have no guidelines that we are going for. So I guess I still am reluctant to get rid of that, because the point is we do need to have official state guides going for you know, at least for a 10-year period.
Ms. Viral.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mason, it's my understanding that MMB is using the results first initiative. And there are specific indicators that they're using through that process.
Who makes up those? Thank you. Who makes up those indicators?
I'm not completely certain. I would have to check and get back to you.
And who uses those indicators?
Representative Mason, go through the chair, please. Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Byro.
I believe that MMB uses those.
Representative Mason, you had a follow-up then.
Okay. Well, going back to this, the point is still the same. As a state, we have no official goals. So when we are passing laws, we're not doing it against a set of goals that we have instituted, and for just the agency to have access to this, to me, makes absolutely no sense. It should be the I would hope it would be the legislature, the governor, that does this, and for them to get rid of this, to me, is not right. So I will leave it there. I don't have time to argue this today, I'm sure. And then I wasn't happy with the change of SHPO over to admin. And maybe if somebody could answer, is there something that is working more effectively now that it is in admin versus when it was with the MHS?
Mr. Kelleher or Ms. Byrell would be the best to answer that. Mr. Kelleher, I see you're on mute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, I think that the transfer means that the office is doing the same work that it had been doing before. It's virtually the same staff, and they're in a different organizational structure. They have a different reporting structure. They are in the Department of Administration, so report straight up through the Commissioner of Administration to the governor, and I think that was one of the issues that was driving that change. They're doing the same work. They're following the same federal laws and coordinating with state and federal agencies. So I don't have a lot of information about their workload. Obviously, everyone's workload and response time is changed during the pandemic with remote working, and that office still deals with a lot of paper and maps and plans and whatnot. So they've had some challenges in dealing with remote working, but it's essentially the same operation as it was before. We still continue to work with that office on a number of projects. We still do a lot of historic preservation work at our historic sites and our educational programs. So we continue to be colleagues with that office and teammates in this work.
Representative Nash, you mentioned that you were part of that. It's your hand up to talk about that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Maybe you can get some light.
Mr. Chair, to that question or comment, I think it's the staff is doing very much the same work, but it's removing, quite honestly, upper level leadership or a reporting structure, as I think Mr. Kelleher called it, that was becoming problematic for the advancement of projects. And that was really the impetus for the move to its new home. And based on everything that I'm hearing, Representative Mason, that things are going much better, that the people who are trying to work with the office feel that they're being treated more fairly, that things are moving more rapidly, and that there are less capricious delays. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Mason, we're going to move on to the next questioner. You had your multiple
Thank
questions.
You.
Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm in agreement with Representative Mason. I struggle with the idea that we're not going to continue to do this report. And at a minimum, Mr. Chair, I think the committee needs to dig into this more and understand what the alternative report that Ms. Byrell talked about is and what it looks like. I'm just looking for members' reference, the section that outlines the report, which is in chapter 4, refers to a section in 16A, and I'll read it. It says, for each change item in the budget proposal requesting new or increased funding, the budget document must present proposed performance measures that can be used to determine if the new or increased funding is accomplishing its goal. So that is still in statute if this particular part of the bill passes. And it would be remiss not to let people know whether or not that is being accomplished. And so I share Representative Mason's concern, and I hope that we can dig into this and get a better understanding before we push this part forward. Also, I had a question, Mr. Chair, for Ms. Byrell under the Environmental Sustainability Government Operations Office. Ms. Burrell, can you give us a little more on that? Apparently the governor did an executive order. If indeed he did an executive order, now he wants the legislature to adopt his executive order. Is that what you're saying?
Ms. Byron.
We are looking for, a little bit of agreement from the legislature that they are interested in having this office continue.
Representative Skowski, follow-up.
Okay, Mr. Chair, that's not real helpful. I would like to know more about this and the history of its development. Ms. Byrell, how long has this office been operating?
Ms. Byrell.
Mr. Chair, I believe it began in 2017. It was first enacted under Governor Dayton. And the office does assist agencies to help achieve their the statewide sustainability goals, and also to with a real focus on reducing energy costs and reducing waste.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Skowski.
Thank you. And Ms. Byrell, do we know how are they funded? Where is the authority for funding them, and where does that come from? And can you comment on that?
Ms. Byrell.
Mr. Chair, we currently operate under an interagency agreement. So agencies provide a little bit of resources for the office, and in return, they get assistance in managing their, reducing their energy costs and reducing their different waste.
Representative Skowski, your last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Byrell. Just a comment. I find this very troubling. We have government for the last coming up on 4 years now has been operating on its own, creating a new office, deciding to fund it on its own. The executive branch has, Mr. Chair, without the authority of the legislative branch to create it. I think we all, Republican or Democrat, need to pause at seeing what is happening here. You got the executive branch creating brand new agencies within the executive branch. That's not how it's supposed to work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Druskowski. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Chair. Could we have a little clarification on how the census data works? My kind of concern or question is, I understand the bill says that the data needs to be distributed or sent out within 6 weeks. And I just want to make sure that if the data is ready before, sooner than that, that would be encouraged.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to refer to one of the testifiers to be more succinct in responding to that. I believe we have, I had a name. Ms. Byrell, perhaps if you could provide a quick response, and then if there are others that can speak more specifically to the demographers.
And Representative Koznick, I've been following the census stuff, and again, it was all been delayed from what it is that we're supposed to have that information. I believe it's June 1st, so that we can start our process of drawing lines and whatnot. And because it was delayed at the federal level, because of the pandemic, it got pushed back, and so they're pushing back. Otherwise, they'd have to start doing work without having the information they need. But Ms. Byrell, if you can answer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That's absolutely right. Normally, we would be getting that information in March or April so that we could distribute that to the legislature and local governments. And that June 1st deadline is the normal deadline that we would be disseminating that information. Because the Census Bureau has said they won't have that until at least September 30th, we will miss that June 1st deadline. And so we want to say only when in years that have decennial census, we will get that information to local governments at least 6 weeks after it is given to us by the U.S. Census Bureau.
Representative Kosick.
What is the normal turn time once they get the data that they release it to the legislature and stuff? It seems, my concern would be is that the administration would hold on to the data, decipher it for a different advantage, rather than release it to the legislature if they have the luxury of sitting, being able to statutorily sit on it. So I guess my preference would be that I want to know how long do they need to sit on it and work with it before they release it, and then have it released as quickly as possible that they're able to. And I understand the pandemic and the delay and all that, so that's not really my question. It's more of I want to help understanding the timing of it, please.
Ms. Byrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, generally that is about the same turnaround time that we would have, is about 6 weeks. And also we want to make sure, we anticipate that there will be a lot of requests from the State Demographic Center during that time. So we want to be able to accommodate that during that time while having enough time to also disseminate it to the local governments.
Representative Kosick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fine.
Okay. No further questions, members. We'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, just a quick closing comment.
Representative Carlson, thank you. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of follow up from some of the previous conversation, I would like to just direct members and those that may be watching to the Results First Initiative webpage. It's part of the Management and Budget website. I think this gets to where a lot of the information is being currently held. The introduction just reads, Minnesota is a leader in evidence-based policymaking. The Results First Initiative is one way the state uses rigorous research, local expertise, and data to give policymakers valuable information when making decisions. So I would encourage you all to check it out. I do use it. When I was kind of tipped off to this website, I do refer to it on a regular basis, and I think you will find it extremely helpful.
Representative Nash, you had your hand up and it went down. And
I'm good.
Okay, Representative Nash, thank you. With that, members, I thought the part about letting the canine officers reside with their handlers would probably be most controversial piece, but I guess I was wrong. Anyway, members, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Carlson. And members, I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Carlson. The next bill is mine. Representative Carlson?
Yes, thank you, Chair Nelson. Give me just a second to get caught up with everything here. Okay, next on the agenda is we have House File 1685. This is the SEIU contract ratification. Chair Nelson,
I move House File 1685 to be referred to Health and Human Services Finance and Policy. And okay. There's an amendment, members, and it's a very technical amendment.
Wonderful. So we have a author's amendment. Chair Nelson, if you want to describe the amendment, or if it's just a matter of getting the bill in the form that you prefer.
It's members, if you look at the bill, there's page 1, line 7, there's dots, there's the blank space where the dates, and that was the date that these contracts were heard by the SCR, I believe it is. Anyway, this just inserts the date, of March 1st, 2021, so it's a very technical amendment.
Okay. Any questions with regards to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, everybody can unmute themselves, please. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Any opposed, say no. The amendment is adopted. So with that, we've got the bill in the order before us. Chair Nelson, if you would like to present your bill.
And members, again, this is the contract. House File 1685 is the contract that was originally agreed upon with the self-directed home care workers that are represented by SEIU Union, the healthcare union. The contract is funded in a different bill, House File 1434, which is going to be heard in, which was heard in helping the Human Services Finance Committee yesterday. The funding is also carried in House File 1040, the Governor's Human Services Budget Bill. The ratification language this ratification language be or heard or added to that bill when it's heard. The contract was submitted to the Legislative Coordinating Committee and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations with an advisory that has advisory role during session. This will be the fourth contract these workers have had since they gained a right to form a union. And as the author of that bill, I'm proud of the progress that we've made. The contract currently covers approximately 2,900 workers in those self-directed home care programs. They include PCA Choice Program, where clients qualify for hours of service, and the two budget programs, the Medicaid-funded consumer-directed community services support program and the state-only consumer support grant program. These programs are all self-directed by the client, who recruits, trains, and supervises the workers. The agency serves only as the fiscal entity to process the payroll for these people. And it doesn't include the traditional workers that work for traditional agencies in our agency PCA programs. In that program, the agency hires, trains, and supervises the workers on behalf of the client. Those workers are private sector employees of that agency. I should note also that while those workers are not covered by this contract, the agency will receive the same rate increase without the same requirement to pass the funding along to workers. These workers predominantly are women and people of color, have been on the front line of, as essential workers during the COVID pandemic. They're risking their lives and always without adequate PPE or paid quarantine leave. They have helped our elderly and disabled stay in their homes and out of nursing homes, which saves the state money and saves those people money. That has also been one of the hot spots that we've had the most deaths from the COVID is in those nursing homes because of the congregation the way they are. The contract is small recognition of their historic efforts. The contract raises the hourly wage, base wage from $13.25 to $14.40 on October 1st of this year and to $15.25 on July 1st of next year. That is important for three reasons. First, the higher wages will help fight the enormous workforce shortages we face in the home care industry. Even before this pandemic, there were at least 8,000 unfilled home care positions in Minnesota. The shortage grows worse every day as our population ages. And even worse, if we fail to provide them with the care they need to stay in their homes and communities, we will spend more on care for them in expensive nursing homes. Second, the Minneapolis Municipal Minimum Wage is scheduled to increase to approximately $15 on July 1st of next year. And by ratifying this contract, we keep these self-directed workforce above that level. And it also ensures that the private sector, traditional PCA agencies are reimbursed at a sufficient level. Before I turn this over to MMB to fully explain the details of the contract, I want to highlight some important points. This is a bipartisan effort. Senator Howe was the Senate author, and along with Senator Miller being the author of Senate File 1701, the Senate companion to this bill. I would like to thank Representative Precia for co-authoring this bill with me. And second, this is an open shop contract. Although all the workers are in the union enjoy the benefits of the contract, no worker is required to join the union or pay union dues or fair share dues. So with that, I'd like to turn this over to MMB, Ms. Klassman, and there was a couple other testifiers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nelson. Yes, the first on our list of testifiers is Ms. Jennifer Klassman. Ms. Klassman, if you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Vice Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Klassman, Enterprise Director of Labor Relations, Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a brief overview of the negotiations process and the highlights of the SEIU contract changes. I know that there are other testifiers here regarding this bill, so I'll keep my comments brief this morning. Under law, Minnesota Management and Budget is charged with negotiating the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota contract. SEIU Healthcare Minnesota represents the bargaining unit of home care workers and represents approximately 29,000 individual providers. On January 16th, 2021, MMB reached a tentative agreement with SEIU. This is the fourth contract negotiated between the parties, and if ratified, will be in effect for 2 years from July 1st, 2021 through June 30th, 2023. The negotiations took place in the months preceding the state's legislative sessions. We began in October 2020, and the parties met over the course of 11 days between October and January 2021. The tentative agreement includes a $2 per hour increase in the wage floor over the course of the agreement. So current wage floor is $13.25 per hour. That'll increase to $14.40 per hour on October 1st, 2021, or upon federal approval of a state plan and waiver amendment, whichever is later. And then increase to $15.25 per hour on July 1st, 2022. Under these wage floor increases, those employed home care workers in Minneapolis and St. Paul will be able to meet the minimum hourly rates of pay under the city ordinances. There will be $1.5 million in state funding for home health care worker trainings. That funding goes towards providing the trainings and stipends for home care workers who attend professional development trainings that build on their skills, allows them to provide their clients with safer and higher quality care. There'll be two floating holidays each fiscal year that allows Minnesota home care workers with pay at time and a half for work on those days, many of whom are providing essential care on holidays in order to allow their clients to celebrate with their families. There'll be an increase in the paid time off accruals, so going from 1 hour for every 40 hours worked to 1 hour for every 30 hours worked. That helps Minnesota home care workers continue to receive a full paycheck when their client's unavailable for home care services or they themselves are unable to work due to illness or otherwise. These wage increases allow program participants receiving services from individual providers to attract and retain workers across the state in the home care field. Individual providers provide care to our state's elderly or individuals with a disability with meeting their daily living needs, ensuring people may adequately function in their homes and that they have safe access to Minnesota communities all across the state. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Klausman. Appreciate your testimony. Next on our list of testifiers is Mr. Rick Varco. Mr. Varco, if you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'm just here to answer questions. Damon Livestead is our testifier.
Fantastic. Thanks for being with us today, Mr. Varco. Our next testifier then is Damon Livestead. If you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Damon Livestead, and I've been a home care client for almost 30 years. I served on the bargaining committee that negotiated this contract, and I'm testifying on behalf of SEIU Healthcare, Minnesota. SEIU represents almost 40,000 healthcare workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. I currently live in Plymouth with my parents and have several caregivers who come to our home to help me throughout the week. Without adequate care, many people like myself find it extremely difficult to recruit and retain home care workers to help us with our basic needs, maintain a job, and be involved in our communities. In some instances, we are left with no other option than to move into expensive nursing homes, group homes, or other long-term facilities. When I can't find enough people to cover all my shifts, my parents, who are supposedly retired, have to help fill in. Obviously, as my parents, they'll do whatever they need to ensure my cares are met. Unfortunately, they are now in their mid and late 70s, and lifting and dressing me has become very difficult for them and impossible for either of them to do individually. My mom has almost constant back and shoulder pain due to years of caring for me. Finding home care workers is not only crucial for my safety and well-being, but to theirs also. Today I'm fine, but what about next week, next month or next year when my parents can no longer help care for me? Will I find enough help to stay at home, or will I need to move into a living facility? Lack of home coworkers not only affects my personal activities of daily living and home life, but it also affects my ability to continue to work and be involved in the community. This February, I celebrated 28 years of employment as a mechanical engineer at Barry Raymond Flexible Systems in Northeast Minneapolis. Again, because I live at home, when I don't have help, my parents make sure I'm able to get ready for and to work when needed. Most people aren't that fortunate, however, and as a result, many struggle to find and maintain jobs. By supporting this new tentative agreement between SCA or Healthcare Minnesota and the Department of Human Services, we can move towards recognizing the critical work done by home care workers and start paying them liberal wages and benefits they deserve. This will help thousands of disabled and elderly Minnesotans across the state who rely on home care workers daily. Taking care of elderly and disabled is an issue that unites all members of this community. I want to thank Chair Nelson and Senator Miller for making this a bipartisan issue. We are proud of the bipartisan support we have gotten for so many years. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Livestead, thank you so much for your testimony and for being with us here today. We do have a few member questions. I don't have any more testifiers on the list, so we will move to member questions. First on my list, I have Representative Draskowski. Representative Draskowski, if you want to please proceed with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nelson, for the bill. Mr. Chair, do we have a spreadsheet that shows us the fiscal impact of this contract, including history, like we've been provided at least in the Subcommittee on Employee Relations every time in the past? I don't see it in the packet.
I'm sorry, Representative Draskowski, I believe Ms. Roberts could possibly address that question. Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair and members, I would probably defer to Michelle Weber. I know there was some fiscal information in the email that was just sent around at the beginning of the hearing.
Right. Ms. Weber, are you with us? I don't see you on my screen.
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. I'm Michelle Weber. I'm the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And distributed to members was a copy of the summary that's been provided to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. We received the contract on Monday evening and made the summary available on Wednesday of this week. The last page of that summary document includes an overview of the cost to implement the contract. So if ratified, there would be a $19.6 million cost in fiscal year 22, a $47.9 million cost in fiscal year 23, $50.7 million in fiscal year 24, and then $53.1 million in fiscal year 25. And the table on that sheet does break out the costs of the various provisions that have fiscal implications.
Representative Draskowski, any follow-up?
Well, certainly, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well, Ms. Weber, I don't have the sheet. I don't know where it is. I expected there would be in our meeting packet. But can you tell me where it is, Ms. Weber?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that the committee legislative administrator emailed it to the members.
And that would have been this morning, Representative Draskowski. I believe that was just emailed out this morning. Should be top of your inbox.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm looking. I'm searching for Ms. Rudolph, and I don't see it. Maybe my tired eyes aren't honing in on it. But I don't see it. So, Mr. Chair,
I'm being told it was actually sent by Ms. Spreck. Sydney Spreck would have sent the email.
Okay, I will attempt to find that as we continue the discussion. But, Mr. Chair, this continues a trend that's happened here in this discussion between the executive branch and the legislature, the subcommittee on employee relations, for the last dozen years or more. The forthcoming of information about these contracts has been difficult at best, and it's really frustrating. And in my years serving on subcommittee on employer relations, I needed a crowbar in order to get information most of the time. Mr. Chair, members, these contracts represent millions and hundreds of millions of dollars, oftentimes of increases in spending to the state government budget. For us to not have those available and digest before a meeting like this is irresponsible. This is the fiscal committee that is responsible for overlooking these contracts. And I don't know how we can make a decision on a single two paragraph or one paragraph sheet from the MMB commissioner that says, oh, here's the cover letter that says we've received the contract. It represents 29,000 employees. That tells us nothing. And so as a member of this committee, I'm just bringing forward my continued frustration. And of course, Mr. Chair, the cynical side of me says when Democrats negotiate with Democrats, this is what you get. But that's the cynical side of me, okay? But it's very frustrating for me as a member of this legislature to continue to see this, and there's been no change. I have, as a member of the subcommittee on employer relations in the past, had to issue memos and letters to Mr. Hubinger and others in order to get additional information because they wouldn't provide sufficient enough information. Here we don't even have it ahead of time. Could Ms. Weber or somebody, I don't have the numbers, I heard $14, $15, and I don't remember what the base, 13 something to begin with. Can somebody tell us what the percentage increases is? I do have an old sheet that I think Mr. Hubinger produced a year or two ago that's said in the 2019 line item anyway for this particular union, that it was a 10.7% increase across that biennium. I'm curious what the increase across this biennium is for this particular bargaining unit.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I just found it in my emails, and I re-forwarded to Representative Ruskowski, but in the memo that we got there, it shows the total costs for FY22, 23, 24, and 25, and it was sent to us this morning by Ms. Spreck.
Right. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Yes, I was going to point out the same thing. So, Representative Draskowski, take a look at that. In the meantime, let's let Ms. Weber provide a response, and then we can get back to you, but then I'm going to move on to our next
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could come back again after I have a chance to review that, I appreciate it.
Very fair. Okay. Representative Claiborne, you're next on my list.
Mr. Chair, and I actually just have a comment. I would like to thank Mr. Levistead for being with us this morning and for all of the great work that he does to serve the persons with disabilities who live in our community, and for his tireless, tireless effort to make sure that the individuals who serve people with disabilities are paid wages where they can support their families. There are so many individuals in our communities all across our state who provide these life-saving services to our neighbors, our family members, and to our friends who have, it cannot be that their hard work in serving our neighbors and friends goes unnoticed. And we need to provide the wages that allow them to continue to provide these life-saving services and to recognize their hard work has value and meaning and that they too are able to pay their bills and care for their own families while providing these critical services. And as we are trying to address the PCA shortage all around our state, to be able to have families do, or to have individuals do this work is reliant upon them being able to pay their own bills. Good service and good intentions does not help them when they go to the grocery store. They need wages that allow them to provide for their families as well. So to Mr. Levistad, thank you so much for being a tireless advocate for the people who work with you and for you every day, and also for the people who are in need of the services. Your efforts, I just cannot sing your praises enough for the work that you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. I couldn't agree with you more. Next on our list of questions is Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins, if you would like to proceed with your question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't have a question. I like Representative Claiborne, I have a comment as well, but I don't see any other hands up. So I think we can go into the discussion. I just want to reiterate what Representative Claiborne said. And the work that that I've done in this area, what I'm finding is that people who need this kind of assistance frequently go months without it because the agencies that hire and train personal care attendants have such an incredibly high rate of turnover. Opportunity Partners, which is in my district, said that they have a turnover rate of 30 to 50% a year in these jobs. And it's just because these jobs don't pay enough. They don't the pay just does not reflect the work, the training, the dedication that's required to do these jobs. And this pay increase is absolutely necessary if we're going to have any hope at all of providing the people who need these services with those services. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Okay, so just wanted to quickly acknowledge Ms. Bailey from DHS to provide some response to the line of questioning from Representative Drazkowski. Ms. Bailey, do you want to provide some further insights in terms of the financials?
Hello, Chair, members. Elise Bailey, Fiscal Policy Director for the Department. I don't know, can you see me? My video must not be working, but I am here.
There you are. It just popped up.
Yes, I am here to provide any information that you might want related to the cost of this provision. Essentially, the cost is to our Medicaid program. These workers work with services paid through MA, and therefore the changes in this agreement, the wage increases and the benefit increases require the state to increase the rate paid for those programs for personal care assistance and CDCS or consumer directed community supports and the CSG program. So I am here to provide any additional information if you have detailed questions beyond the spreadsheet that was sent out by Ms. Weber.
Wonderful. We have just a few minutes left. So Representative Drazkowski, I see your hand is not up, but did you have a quick follow-up question before we move to Chair Nelson to do a wrap-up for us?
Well, I've got questions, Mr. Chair. I don't know how quick or follow-up they are, but I'm wondering if the last person from DHS could talk about, I did open the document that Representative Nelson sent, and it does outline the financial provisions. I'd like to see this laid out, Mr. Chair, in a table like Mr. Hubinger used to always produce, and I'm surprised that that's not available. It always had been available even before this point in the process of discussion of the contracts during the SER process, it had been provided. So I don't know why we are seeing regression on the provision of information to members, but it would be really incumbent upon the government to do that, and I would encourage them to do so. But I do see under the financial provisions, 1440 is the increase on October 1st of 2021. What is the current amount again? And then what is the increase from the current amount to that October 1st amount as a percentage? And then what is the increase from the current amount to the July 1st, 2022 amount of $15.25 an hour? What is that as a percentage?
Ms. Weber, I believe we can direct that question to you.
Mr. Chair and members, I would be hesitant to do math on the fly. I did pull up the previous information related to the fiscal year 21-21 fiscal year 20 and 21 contract and the total costs associated with those contracts, but I can absolutely follow up with that information. I think it might be detrimental for me to try and do math on the fly. Okay. And I am the new director of the LCC. I know that you all had a longstanding experience working with Greg Hubinger, and I'm committed to making sure that I'm providing you the same level of information that's been provided in the past. I believe the document that you're referring to, Representative Drazkowski, is the settlement sheet, and I will work to make sure that we have that available as well. And that's a summary of all of the negotiated contracts that get submitted to the SER. This is the first one that's been submitted to the SER for the fiscal year 22-23 biennium. The other contracts will be negotiated in the coming months.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Weber. If you can follow up with the committee administrator, that would be fantastic.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could with Ms. Weber, I appreciate that. And Ms. Weber, I'd actually encourage a more detailed effort than Mr. Hubinger put forward. He did put forward for me 1 year in response to a memo, and I could go grab that and at some point and get that to you, but we need to be able to actually see the increases in amounts as a salary, the healthcare benefit increases, the other component increases that many times are not included even in the settlement sheet. This is very important stuff. This affects a lot of people. It affects a lot of taxpayers, and it's a huge impact on our budget. The amount of information that the government has been forthcoming with in the past has not been adequate. And so I would like to work with you, Ms. Weber, on that. Can somebody remind me, what is the current level of pay right now, Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry, Representative Drazkowski, we got to end our questioning here. I'm getting the look from House TV that we need to cut this off and move to a vote. Chair Nelson, a really quick wrap-up, and then we will renew your motion.
Mr. Chair, my wrap-up. The current rate is $13.25, and it's going to $14.40 on October 1st. And members, this bill is not being funded in our department. Ratification of the contract comes to us. This is being funded and was actually already heard in HHS before. So members, thanks for the time in the committee. I appreciate a yes vote.
Excellent. So Chair Nelson renews his motion to refer House File 1685 as amended to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Nash. Representative Nash.
He texted me he had to step out.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Claiborne.
Aye.
Representative Koznick.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Quam. Representative Quam. With a vote of 10 ayes, 1 nay, and 2 absent, the motion prevails.
Wonderful. The motion prevails. Members, our next meeting is Monday, March 8th. We've got at 5 o'clock, by the way, 5 o'clock. So Monday, March 8th, 5 o'clock. We've got three bills on the agenda. Look forward to seeing you then. We have no further business, members. With that, the meeting is adjourned.